Punch. It wasn't a question, more a delivery of an uncomfortable fact that neither of us wanted to hear, like announcing that a nearby nuclear plant just exploded. Oh, I said back, and then, without thinking, sure, I'll be around. God damn it, why, in this moment, I didn't think to come up with an excuse, literally any excuse, is beyond me. This is what I do. I panic, I say yes to things, I can't say no, especially not to food. What was I supposed to do now? I considered driving my bike into traffic just for a believable pardon.
Oh, okay, cool, Troy said.
I could tell he was thinking the same thing. I wasn't supposed to say yes. He was just delivering the message, one I'm sure his parents forced him to deliver. Either that, or all of his other friends were too obnoxiously fratty to bring around, and I was simply the safest option. As far as they knew, I was Troy's only friend. When the weekend came, we walked silently to the only brunch place in town where his parents were waiting. They were just as serious-looking as the first time I'd met them on move-in day nearly a year ago. Stern and intellectual, both doctors. The entire meal, Troy barely spoke more than a few sentences, lifting his eyes from his plate only to stick his knife in the cup of butter or to take a sip of orange juice. It felt like we'd all just gone to the same funeral. So I'm gonna have to be the one who turns this meal around, I thought, just like I fix everything in this relationship. For the rest of the meal, I spoke to Troy's parents as if they were my own, regaling them with stories of our inseparable friendship, the nights we spent keeping one another awake, watching movies, and comforting ourselves to sleep. What can I say? I know how to work for a free meal. A month later, as the school year was coming to an end and my time with Troy was finally almost over, I had my own moment of drunken weakness. By then, I'd been selected as the dorm historian, a meaningless role that had only one responsibility, writing the dorm newsletter. Except the newsletter wasn't actually a newsletter, but an onion-like page of satire taped to the back of the dorm's bathroom stalls, a dumb piece of potty time entertainment that fell to me. For the last issue, I drank perhaps a few too many sips of cheap boxed wine while I was writing and concocted a list, cleverly titled, Things Not to Do While Your Roommate is Sleeping. In my defense, for the most part, the list was entirely innocent. At least 90% of it had absolutely nothing to do with Troy. Things like don't eat a bag full of cured salamis and cheeses, and don't perform maintenance on your personal pubic hedges, no matter how aggressively your freakishly pubescent body parts have begun to shed their fur. And of course, being the drunk asshole that I can be, I added as a final touch, and in caps for unmistakable emphasis, and most important, don't masturbate while you think your roommate is sleeping. Troy, I'm talking to you. I know what you did. Save, print 40 copies, tape to the back of 40 bathroom stalls, wait to be murdered. Now, before you write me off as a terrible asshole who broke some kind of deep, unspoken code about never tattling on your midnight masturbating roommate, it was ostensibly a newsletter full of satire. At the very worst, everybody should have assumed I was making a horrible joke, except for all of the people I told the truth, which included basically everybody. Regardless, Troy never mentioned it, either because he never shit in our dorm or because he pretended, as always, he was too cool to care. In any case, Troy was the last man I ever, reluctantly, shared a bedroom with. And I hope this story stands as a warning to any man who may consider sharing a bedroom with me in the future. Let it be known that this is my territory. What happens here is in my control. And if you try to secretly masturbate behind my back, I will tell everybody we know that it happened. On Living Alone in New York City. There's a point in the process of searching for an apartment in New York City, perhaps when you're standing in a paper bag turned bedroom, staring at a toilet beneath a kitchen sink next to an icebox plugged into a power strip that's dangling from a hole in the wall, when you start to wonder if death might truly be the answer. A coffin costs less for the same square footage, after all. It's got hardwood finishing, with bedding and draperies already installed, no year-end rent increases, no neighbors to complain that the TV is too loud, a solid foundation, and most important, no roommates to judge you for decaying in the same spot all weekend. It's really the perfect arrangement, all things considered. But a coffin isn't always the answer, which is how I found myself, like millions of would-be New Yorkers every year, in search of a place my living, breathing body could occupy for less than the cost of sacrificing my firstborn. Though, to be fair, I'd gladly sell my unborn children to a labor camp in exchange for a two-bedroom Greenwich Village loft with a washer and dryer. I first moved to New York City 4 years ago, and by most standards, my first apartment, in the deep Brooklyn neighborhood where Meryl Streep's character lived in that movie where she kills one of her kids, was an absolute mansion. I had a bedroom that fit both a mattress and pillows, a bathroom with a mirror, and a kitchen with a window. The neighbors I shared a wall with only had vigorous animal sex once in 3 years, as far as I could hear, and I found only one or two cockroaches near the refrigerator, but they were both already dead, so that basically doesn't even count. Any apartment in New York with a mirror, a window, and a mysterious air for killing cockroaches is luxury living. Of course, like many New Yorkers, I had a roommate. A former college classmate named Lindsay, who is too pure for this world, and certainly too pure for the havoc I wrought upon our bathroom and kitchen. For 3 shared years, Lindsay generously cleaned our common spaces every week with no help from me, which I justified by reasoning that she actually must really enjoy cleaning, and she did, I could see it in her eyes, but the truth is, I was lazy and she wasn't, and every time I said I would get around to cleaning the toilet, she would rightfully call my bluff and clean the damn thing herself. Besides, I barely left my bedroom or made our apartment feel like anything more than a hole that I hibernated in when I wasn't out getting drunk. I was an awful roommate and an even worse person, but Lindsay never called me out on it. She just channeled her disapproval into cleaning the toilet and letting the shiny, spotless porcelain bowl speak for itself. The guilt I felt for imposing my monstrous lifestyle on someone as genuine and gentle as her was too much to bear. I ended our 3 years of shared mansion living and began my search for a private nest I could destroy guiltlessly on my own. There are a lot of factors to consider when trying to find a new apartment, especially if you, like me, spend 23 hours a day decomposing indoors. Your apartment walls have to contain your sounds and smells. Your door must be thick enough to ensure any potential callers always assume you're not at home. And your neighbors must be of the kind that are prepared to see a specimen like yourself emerge, golem-like, once daily to retrieve carbohydrates and alcohol. Finding an apartment means you have to find the answers to a laundry list of questions that, at first, seem entirely unimportant, but prove to be the most important questions of all. Like, how cute are the local Starbucks baristas? Can you imagine yourself carrying out a sordid love affair with the tallest, handsomest one, communicated only through messages drawn in cappuccino foam atop your daily lattes? Will he find you the day you decide to move away and tell you that he wants you to stay? No, he needs you to stay, because he can't imagine his life without you, can't imagine what his days would be like without your smile walking through those doors every morning. These are the types of questions they don't tell you to ask, but they matter. Also, how shirtless is the local running community? How often does the Italian family who lives next door use an entire head of garlic to make marinara sauce for breakfast? Do the tenants who live directly above your prospective unit own an elephant or other large elephant-like animal with diabetes, causing it to roam across the hardwood floors multiple times a night to relieve its diseased elephant-sized bladder? And perhaps most important, what size towel do the neighborhood bachelors use to wrap themselves post-shower, and how thin are their bedroom curtains? Armed with the right questions, I tried at first to find an apartment on my own. If I was going to strike out on my own, I figured I should really go for it. Brokers, after all, are a sleazy breed of human who don't give a shit whether you live or die. They'll gladly sell your dream apartment to the couple waiting behind you with their IKEA bed frame at the ready, prepared to swoop in and claim the room you plan to masturbate in for their own perverted pursuits, like having sex with each other at the same time. Like monsters. But you realize how quickly and drastically you're willing to drop your standards when you try anything on your own. Poring through Craigslist, I found only one listing in my price range, albeit one I found virtually impossible to refuse. It was a luxury downtown loft, furnished to perfection and completely free. The only catch, in exchange for free room and board, the man listing the apartment demanded to spoon-feed his tenant 3 meals a day.
Look, I told my parents, it's got exposed brick walls, stainless steel appliances, a Whirlpool bathroom, and it's all for free. And it comes with 3 meals every single day, and I won't even have to feed myself. I'll never have to worry about going hungry again. But that day, some guy got killed by some other guy because they met on Craigslist or something equally violent and tragic, and of course, that was the one night my parents decided to watch the news, and then suddenly everyone on Craigslist offering a free apartment in exchange for spoon-feeding their tenant 3 meals a day must be a killer. I tried telling them that everyone in New York City is a potential murderer. I mean, that's sort of the city's deal. Lindsay probably tried killing me in my sleep plenty of times, and I survived living with her for 3 whole years. What's a guy with a spoon fetish gonna do? Feed me to death? But I was forced to relent. I abandoned both my hopes for a generous apartment sugar daddy and the prospect of successfully finding an apartment alone. So I hired a broker named Pam, recommended by a friend. Pam was an older, oversized woman in her 60s who moved like she was running away from a very small, very sluggish axe murderer, which is to say, she barely moved at all, but in a very urgent way. She took deep breaths in the middle of her sentences and spoke cautiously, like someone was listening to our conversation. Her attention was always half-focused on what was happening around us, and so she never quite seemed to notice what I was saying. I thought you were supposed to be a girl, was the first thing she said to me, outside the building where we planned to meet. No, I'm a dude, I said. I texted her I was Ariel's friend Matt, and I'm looking for an apartment, but I realize now I might not have been clear enough. Is that gonna be a problem? I asked her then. She shrugged her shoulders and heaved herself inside anyway. I followed along, uncertain. We climbed into the elevator together. You're the first one to see this apartment, she huffed. The landlord didn't get me the keys until today. A piece of work, he is. She turned to me and made sly eye contact. The kind of guy who beats his wife, you know? I opened my mouth, but no words came out. I mean, what the fuck are you supposed to say to something like that? The kind of guy who beats his wife? Does he beat his wife or not, Pamela? If he does, why are you so casual about this? If he doesn't, what the fuck are you talking about? I looked at the ground. Okay, that's something. We didn't say anything else. The elevator doors opened, and Pam led me 20 feet down the hallway to the apartment. She burst through the door and collapsed immediately onto the closest piece of furniture she could find, out of breath from the taxing elevator ride and stroll. Granted, we were on the 8th floor, and it's possible the high altitude was harsh on her feeble lungs. Make yourself useful and turn on the air conditioner, she barked. I did as she asked, and left her to defrost while I reviewed the apartment, though there wasn't much to review. It was a one-room studio, big enough to fit a small bed, a couch, and a dying old woman without feeling too crowded. There was a tiny bathroom and a kitchenette, and 2 windows that faced a solid brick wall so nobody could see in or out. Pam's phone rang and she answered. She spoke to the other person for 5 minutes, hung up, and turned to me. One of my friends just died. Breath. He was like a mentor to me. Breath. Anyway, you want this apartment or not? I paused for a second. I looked around for hidden cameras. And then I told Pam, no, I wasn't interested in this beautiful litter box of an apartment, but maybe the next one. And also, are you sure your blood pressure isn't dangerously low today? Because that's the only fucking explanation I can fathom for a woman behaving as strangely as you are, except I didn't say any of that because I'm too polite. I just said, no thank you, ma'am. Now, please can we go before you murder me? And then we left. The next day, I got too drunk at a bar, probably because it had been 48 whole hours since I'd started looking for an apartment, and I hadn't found one yet, and I was ready to die. I was slumped at a table, my friend Jennifer standing 15 feet away at the bar. Bring me water, homo, I texted her. She didn't immediately reply, so I texted her again. Don't be a homophobe. Bring me a water. Drunk Matt assumes the worst of people very quickly. Still no response, I texted her a third time. Why do you hate gays? Nothing. A few minutes later, she walked over to the table and sat down. Why aren't you answering my texts? I slurred. Because you didn't text me, she said. And that's when I realized I hadn't been calling Jen a raging pro-dehydration homophobe. I was calling Pam the broker a raging pro-dehydration homophobe. Oh my God, I screamed. I thought I was texting you. Oh my God, I'm so sorry, I texted Pam the broker. I don't think you hate gays. But she never replied, and I never heard from Pam the broker again. The next week, I found Pam's replacement, a broker named Mark. He looked suspiciously like Mr. Clean if Mr. Clean had served time in a federal corrections facility for cooking meth. His shiny bald head was punctuated by bulging skull veins, and his biceps were kept at a solid 75% flex at all times. In truth, I chose him because I was too scared not to choose him. Somehow I thought he'd find me and rent me an apartment and make me move there whether I wanted him to or not. But Mark, like Pam, proved to be a person of many oddities. On our way to view our first apartment, he stopped me mid-sentence to ogle two women passing us on the sidewalk. Sorry, buddy, he said. I just get so distracted by beautiful women. You understand, though. I most certainly did not. The apartment we found was smaller than the one Pam showed me, but livable enough, and Mark's biceps seemed to throb in approval. Sure, it didn't have an oven or a fully closable bathroom door, and the toilet was barely bigger than one of those training potty seats parents use to put on top of normal-sized toilets to teach their babies how to shit like civilized humans. But whatever. I was running out of time, and Mark's skull veins weren't getting any calmer. 2 days later, I was signing a lease, along with a piece of paper that said I'd promised not to lick the walls. For real, the lease agent said it was totally standard. Just a little thing that says you won't sue us if you chew on the windowsills, he told me. I signed it, but still, it's a pretty fucked up thing to ask of someone. I should be free to chew on whatever I want in my own apartment. I finally had my own apartment to destroy at will, which is perhaps the greatest feeling in the world. To have the freedom to debase a space that belongs to you, however temporarily, in the manner you wish to debase it. There's nothing greater than sitting on furniture with your bare ass, knowing that it's your furniture to defile, or pissing into an unwashed toilet you know is being seasoned like a skillet with every use, or spilling an entire bowl of cereal in bed, knowing you can ball up the sheets, toss them down the trash chute, and buy new ones the next day with not a single soul to judge you for it. Finding an apartment in New York City is perhaps the greatest struggle, but it yields the greatest and simplest reward. On self-sufficiency. I spend a lot of time thinking about how I will almost definitely be the first one to die in the apocalypse. It's kind of hard not to think about the end of the world when you live in New York City, considering there's already a very fine line between order and chaos here. And all it really takes to send us into primitive panic is a delayed subway train, an inch of snow, or a giant ball of glitter falling in Times Square on New Year's Eve. Anybody who shopped at the Target in Brooklyn knows there are very few rules keeping New York society from descending into all-out bloodshed. I tried returning a microwave there once and left with 3 arrow wounds, a snake bite, and Dutch elm disease, which is technically a disease for trees, but apparently not at Target because nothing matters at Target, especially not the one in Brooklyn. Trust me when I tell you, if the apocalypse strikes New York, whether by way of aliens, zombies, or pandemic, it would take Manhattan less than 1 hour to burn itself to the ground. Everybody in Brooklyn, I assume, would die in the initial invasion. Give us one sighting of a convincing UFO, and we'd all kill one another in the toilet paper aisle at CVS long before CNN told us it was only a stray Goodyear blimp. And yes, I know for a fact, I would be the first one to die. It's not for lack of preparation. I've thought about which of my neighbor's dogs is likely the most nutritious, and how many bottles of whiskey I could drag back to my apartment in one liquor haul. I know where my closest nuclear fallout shelter is, and I know exactly which apartments in my neighborhood are the most expensive and most likely to satisfy my dream post-apocalyptic life of luxury. But mostly, I think about the fact that I would absolutely not make it long enough for any of that to matter. There's really no end-of-the-world scenario I can imagine where I'm not the first to go. If aliens invaded, they'd know right away that I'm not strong or coordinated enough to keep as a human slave and that my body is far too ravaged to conduct any meaningful experiments on. I mean, If you're a superior alien race ransacking Earth for servants and test subjects, you're not going to kidnap a 300-pound homosexual with seasonal depression and hay fever. If a zombie virus struck, I know my luscious, doughy body would be too irresistible to go undetected on the streets. I have no doubt that my layers of fat have created the perfect marbling and that I would be absolutely delicious. If a contagion swept the country, I know my immune system would put up almost no fight. And I know I'm barely tough enough to defend myself against a robot vacuum, let alone a robot army, should one suddenly rise against humanity. I know that I can't run fast enough to stay out of reach, that I take far too many naps to stay alert for danger, and that my past experience with group projects would make it impossible for me to live in a community of survivors without having a meltdown resulting in my inevitable exile. But the real problem, the one that would almost certainly get me killed long before the nuclear radiation charred my body from the inside out, is that I have absolutely no conceivable real-world skills. I can't defend myself, I can't cook for myself, I can barely gather supplies. The contents of my fridge is currently 4 cans, yes, cans, of sparkling wine, an expired carton of milk, and a plastic container of sliced watermelon that I bought because I find cutting my own watermelon to be too much work. In my cabinets, there is only a single box of brown rice that I never finish because brown rice is disgusting, and an old bag of stroganoff noodles that I bought for a slow cooker recipe, but never bother to cook because slow cookers make you think about what you want to eat for dinner 10 hours in advance. And I can only think about what I'm eating as it's entering my body. The only things I am well stocked in are whiskey and face moisturizer, and I can't exactly eat either of those. If the world came crashing down right this moment, I'd have enough supplies to last a few hours at best before I'd be forced to go out into nature where I'd be inevitably mauled, eaten, or enslaved. How did I turn out this way, you ask? I ask myself that question every time I try opening a jar of maraschino cherries or undertake even the most basic of home improvement tasks. I tried installing a curtain rod with a power drill by myself and somehow bored 5 holes in the drywall before I got exactly the right spot. And that's a wall, a completely motionless target. You think I chose to be this inept? No. It was bred into me. I come from a long line of unabashed weaklings, incubating for decades in the comfort and safety of Midwestern middle-class suburbia. My father, who could have spent his time teaching me to hunt venison and identify non-poisonous berries, spent the lion's share of his spare energy collecting antique clocks. Hundreds of them. You don't learn real-world skills from a guy who collects antique clocks. I mean, sure, he could barter the hell out of a cuckoo clock at the flea market, but that's not going to save us from a roving band of post-apocalyptic motor-riding cannibals. And my mother, finding everything to be a danger, left us ill-prepared for greater threats. When you grow up thinking a mouse is the most dangerous thing in the world, what happens when you encounter a guy with a baseball bat covered in barbed wire? Case in point, Chicago, winter 1999, one of the worst winter storms to hit the city in recorded history. In the course of a day, almost 3 feet of snow fell on Chicago and the surrounding suburbs, and in the days after, temperatures reached lows of minus 20 degrees Fahrenheit, which the National Weather Service categorized as extremely fucking cold. It was one of those storms where the weatherman goes outside with a bucket of boiling water, throws it at the sky, and watches as it freezes before it hits the ground. It's a fun little way of saying, we're all going to fucking freeze to death, but at least our bodies will be well preserved. As is often the case when a storm of this magnitude hits, power and phone lines were downed, and we lost electricity. As was not often the case, we lost power for not just a few hours, but 5 entire days. That's 5 whole days with no heat, no lights, no telephone, no hot water, no microwave, and no access to my AOL account. We lived on a dead-end street, which meant no snowplows could forge a path to set us free, although that didn't matter much because every car on the block was almost entirely encased, and the front and back doors of our house were snowed shut. We were, quite literally, buried alive. The only way we could let out the dog to pee was by opening a window and slowly lowering her to the ground with a leash and harness. Now, let me reiterate, we were not a strong family. We relied overwhelmingly on machines to do our brawniest tasks. If we'd all been alive a century and a half earlier and attempted to brave the Oregon Trail, all of us, including our oxen, would have died from dysentery less than a mile from our house. I'm absolutely sure of it. My family could barely survive driving to a restaurant in the same car. We wouldn't have lasted 30 minutes in the same covered wagon. And now we faced our very own winter apocalypse. For 5 nights, we struggled to keep from freezing. We melted snow on the gas stovetop to use as bathing water. We ate what meager food we had by candlelight. After dinner, I played with my rag dolls and pig bladder balloon while Papa played songs on his fiddle. At night, we all slept in the same room to conserve heat, an arrangement that included our 2 hamsters, Muffin and Biscuit, whose cages we covered in blankets to keep them from icing into tiny hamster steaks. As the 5th night began, I started to think our supplies had finally reached their end. My body would be found frozen to the floor, clutching my Beanie Baby collection. Archaeologists would conclude I was trying to keep them warm in a final act of selfless love. Museum exhibits would be built about me. Nameless ginger child found clenching heap of gay stuffed animals. A dissection of his stomach found only strawberry Pop-Tarts and Eggos. But on this very night, just as I was closing my eyes in a peaceful acceptance of frozen death, our neighbors managed to pound away enough ice to knock on our front door and offered to share their spare generator. Apparently, they'd been using one since the storm first knocked out the power and had been living in comparative luxury, less than 20 yards from where I'd been sizing up which hamster would be the most delicious. Muffin, because she was a girl and had more voluptuous, meaty hips. And so, we were saved. Without the kindness of strangers or the aid of a magic electricity machine, we would surely have died and our corpses preserved like the charred victims of that volcano that killed all those people in ancient times. I mean, probably. I'm sure we were totally fine, and my parents will hear this and be like, "That never happened. We knew exactly what we were doing. Why are you always like this?" But I was 9 years old, and it felt like we were definitely going to die. And the fact that I thought we were definitely going to die should be proof enough that I clearly wasn't absorbing any meaningful survival skills. Because that snowstorm was only the beginning of a long series of instances in which my capacity for mastering basic survival skills would be tested. Later that same year, I took my girlfriend to the park. And yes, you'd think that a 9-year-old homosexual having a girlfriend would be the direction I'm going with this, but it's actually not, so just get that right out of your head. I was 9 years old, and she had good clothes and nice hair and agreed to be my girlfriend, so it was absolutely real. Yes, the fact that I didn't know I was gay yet maybe foretold my lack of simple intuition, but that's not really the focus here. We were on a kid date. We rode our bikes to the park together and held hands on the swings, and it would have been a perfectly magical afternoon had we not been confronted by a drifting gang of 5th graders determined to ruin our budding heterosexual romance. I don't know why these 5th graders were so intent on ruining our park date, besides the fact that children are trapped in a Darwinian struggle for a higher place in the playground hierarchy, which makes them unusually vicious and cruel. These children were no exception. Their leader, a skinny but muscly 11-year-old named Kyle, who I'm pretty sure does meth now, approached me and shouted something like, are you on a date with your little girlfriend? And I had to be all like, technically we're not putting any labels on it right now. We're just kind of testing things out and exploring our likes and dislikes. But before I could finish, he started lunging at me like a pimply jaguar pouncing on a portly, defenseless antelope. And I had to react. Now, this is the point where most humans would mount some semblance of a defense, if not for their safety, then at least for their dignity. But I was never taught to fight. My idea of self-defense was to simply avoid danger by never leaving the house. My parents never had to worry about teaching me to defend myself because I was rarely ever in nature long enough to put myself at any reasonable risk. That being said, I guarantee you neither of my parents can throw a punch. So I did the only thing I knew how to do well. I froze. I stood frigid with my hands glued to the sides of my hips like I'd been tied up with invisible rope and waited for impact. When his body collided with mine, I fell to the ground like a toppled tree. And I lay there motionless with his body on top of mine, hoping that if I remained inanimate long enough, he'd think he'd killed me and would move on to his next target. And surprisingly, it worked. He got up while I stayed on the ground with my eyes closed, waiting for death. He and his friends rode away, and I waited until their distant laughter dissipated before I got up, dusted myself off, grabbed my handbag, and rode home silently beside my heterosexual partner. I'd like to think my bully believed my possum act, but more than likely, he took pity on my lifeless body and realized I was too pathetic of a conquest to punish further. Either way, I survived, but only barely. I tell this story not for your pity, but to show you how I behave in the midst of confrontation. When presented with the choice between fight or flight, my body is totally like, you know what, let's just shut it down. Let's just shut this whole thing right on down and reconsider whether it's even worth it. Maybe you're like, it's okay, Matt, plenty of people can't fight, but surely you could still weasel your way through the apocalypse like a coward. But this presumes I have other tested real-world skills. Even if I did manage to fight my way to the grocery store for supplies, I sure as hell wouldn't know what to do with them. I haven't cooked a meal for myself in nearly 6 months, because last time I tried cooking, my apartment smelled like burnt broccoli for 12 agonizing days, and I refused to go through that again. The only successful time I used an oven, I baked a batch of delicious sugar cookies, the Pillsbury kind that you literally just plop on a tray and throw angrily in the oven when you want cookies but you're too lazy to care about life. And when I left them on the kitchen table to cool, an aggressive New York squirrel busted his way through my window and stole them right from the plate. Even when I succeed at basic tasks, my work is easily undone by even the least formidable opponent. I have no doubt if the apocalypse hit tomorrow that a squirrel would eat me well before any human had the chance. And if you think I'd be able to domesticate an animal of my own to help in my defense, well, consider that I've killed almost every pet I've ever been charged with raising. The first pet I had, a beautiful goldfish named Margaret that I'd convinced my parents I was responsible enough to keep alive, lasted less than 1 week before she died in an apparent suicide. Turns out, I was too proud of Margaret, and lugged her bowl from my bedroom every time guests visited so I could show her off, but apparently sloshing a goldfish up and down two flights of stairs every day doesn't provide for the most hospitable of aquatic environments. Rather than endure the tempest I created for her daily, Margaret went on a hunger strike and was found belly up one afternoon when I went to fetch her for her Wednesday walk. Even Muffin the hamster didn't last very long, though she died of what we think was an abdominal tumor that I couldn't possibly have been responsible for, but I still probably had something to do with it. So no, I do not think I would survive the apocalypse. It's amazing I'm even able to stay alive without the apocalypse. Give me the slightest hurdle to jump over, and I guarantee you it kills me before my feet have the chance to leave the ground. On keeping a clean and tidy apartment. 1. Dusting is something you only do if you don't yet realize that dust is a lie perpetuated by the feather industry to make us believe rubbing dead goose wings on your furniture will make them clean. Guess what, feather industry? Furniture is like a cat. It basically cleans itself. 2. Likewise, a shower is a self-contained germ vacuum and only requires an occasional light rinsing or heavy spitting on. I mean, have you ever heard of someone actually cleaning their shower when they're in there basically every day with shampoos and conditioners and shaving creams? I don't think so. 3. It's only really necessary to clean your bathroom once over the course of a year because, think about it, the cave people didn't clean their bathrooms at all. They just shit outside, and they could kill, like, whole mastodons. Not cleaning the bathroom made them stronger. 4. A window basically half belongs to the person on the other side of it, which means you only have to clean windows half as often as you think you should, and the rest of the time is someone else's problem. 5. Sweeping the floors and/or mopping is unnecessary if you wear the right kind of socks. 6. If you can't see the mess, it doesn't exist, which is why baby Jesus invented shag carpeting, closets, and the space between couch cushions. 7. Clothes can be reworn as often as the wearer can stand his own stink, which means laundry is basically always optional, as long as you can convince yourself the smell of your own waste is less offensive than the idea of walking to the nearest washing facility. 8. If you leave the garbage sitting in one spot long enough, it'll eventually be able to take itself out. 9. All dishes are like cast iron skillets. If you don't wash them, each use adds a new layer of delicious seasoning to your next meal. 10. Don't listen to whatever the experts tell you. Sponges last forever. On not being the people's choice. When I was a child, being on TV was the greatest possible thing that could happen to a person. One summer, while I was at my aunt and uncle's house, a drunk driver drove into a house down the street, directly through the wall and into the living room. We heard the crash from a few blocks away and went running to see what happened. Everybody was safe, except for the living room set, I imagine, but it was a big enough disaster to attract the local news community, and soon enough, vans with satellites started rounding the corners, parking along the curb, and hauling out cameras and tripods. It was a spectacle. This was the suburbs, after all. Nothing exciting happened here to begin with, and now there was something besides a television set or bonfire for all of us to stand and stare at. There were lights and microphones and local news reporters furiously dabbing makeup on their sweaty foreheads, all to look at a car that was sitting motionless halfway through a brick wall. But still, whenever one of the camera's lights went bright, my cousins and I would walk aimlessly behind the reporter, far enough away to seem innocuous, but close enough so our faces were clearly captured on screen. Even then, I knew how to find my light. That night, we taped every 11 o'clock news program, who the hell knows which station's cameras we were standing in front of, and the next morning, we went through every tape until they got to the segment about the car, and while the reporter droned on about the damage and how the car would be removed and what hospital the driver was spending the night in, we looked for a hint of ourselves in the back corner, a wisp of hair, or even a shadow. In the end, none of us made it on air. Television cameramen are well-equipped to crop out menacing children like us. But still, the prospect of getting our 15 minutes of fame was tantalizing. We could have been stars. I never quite understood this desire to be on television, at least in this way. This was before the internet was anything beyond instant messaging and chat rooms, when going viral meant you needed to see a doctor. This was before some buffoon grabbing a local news reporter's microphone and shouting something obscene into the camera would end up on YouTube and get a bigger viewership than the news station had gotten that entire year. Even now, I don't understand the verge to go viral this way. Not that there's a desirable way to go viral, let's be honest. But then, standing behind a news reporter meant, at the very best, you'd get 20 seconds of uninterrupted airtime blurring into the background. But I suppose the idea of being on television was titillating, especially to a young, impressionable nerd like myself. Everybody watches TV. Being on TV automatically means you're famous. And being famous is basically the coolest thing in the world. It's the reason those annoying people at baseball games lose their shit whenever the camera pans to them for 5 seconds. It's the reason the entire city of Los Angeles exists. The magic of television. I never thought I'd be on TV after that. In high school, I had a reputation for being a ticking time bomb of embarrassment. Whenever I'd raise my hand to answer a question, or more accurately, whenever I was called on to answer a question, I tried to avoid the spotlight as much as possible. It was only a matter of seconds before all of my blood rushed to my face and my cheeks turned an ungodly combination of beet red and fire. It would take at least another 10 minutes for my face to return to normal. And this lasted well into college. In discussion sections, designed, I'm fairly certain, just so insufferable bros and beanies can philosophize about a book they've never read, I stuck faithfully to the minimum amount of participation required and certainly never engaged in anything close to discussion. Honestly, I was sparing everybody the discomfort of having to be in the same room as someone who could turn as hideously scarlet as I could. This is all to say that I never imagined myself on television, however enticing I found the idea of it, least of all as a nominee for a People's Choice Award for a series of videos I'd made for the internet, and least of all as the unceremonious winner. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Let's start from the beginning. In the summer of 2014, I was working at the internet company BuzzFeed, often categorized as a factory of lists, quizzes, and cat videos, which is not an entirely unfair portrait of what working at BuzzFeed was really like. It was a quintessentially millennial workspace with all the cliches you can possibly imagine, a snack closet stocked with gluten-free candies and granola bars, a row of refrigerators full of seltzer water and beer, iced coffee on tap, visits from internet-famous cats and one particularly adorable mini-horse named Mystic, and rows upon rows of young, talented, creative people. My job, for better or worse, was to make stuff people would find funny and share with their friends. I wrote hundreds of lists and quizzes and even curated my fair share of cat videos. At one point, I was officially listed as a senior editor on the Animals masthead, an accomplishment my journalism professors surely found worthwhile. About 2 years into my job there, I asked my boss if I could get drunk at lunch and review a One Direction album. Trust me, I've had worse ideas. And she said yes. The drunk at work barrier officially broken, it was only a matter of time before I proposed getting drunk in the middle of the day and capturing the whole thing on camera. Now, you might be wondering how someone who hated public speaking to the point of turning into a living beat human would find himself in front of the camera. And the truth is, like all terrible things in life, because of karaoke. I'd never been a fan of karaoke. I found it terribly unpleasant. My first week at BuzzFeed and my first ever week in New York City, there was a party to celebrate the launch of some new section of the website, and we all went to a karaoke bar near the office. I'd been to karaoke before, but always as an unwitting bystander, mumbling the words along with everybody else at an undetectable volume. But this time was different. It was a small, private room, one of those rooms where you can scream as obnoxiously as you want, only disturbing your closest friends instead of complete strangers. This night, everybody was wasted. Everybody was screaming along, nobody could sing. Halfway through the night, the part of the night when everybody's eyes sort of glaze over, one of my new coworkers was on the tiny stage at the end of the room, crooning away, when another coworker got up behind him and started gyrating sensually to the music before taking something out of his pocket, a Mexican wrestling mask, it became apparent as he unfolded it, and placed it on his head. Weird, I thought, but okay, I'm drunk, I can go along with this. And then, still gyrating to the music, he took off his shirt, and underneath, he was wearing a leather Princess Leia bra. It's unclear to me whether he'd slipped this on in the bathroom sometime in the last hour, or if he'd been wearing it the entire day, or if this was something he wore every day. I still have no idea. But what I do know is that I was utterly and completely baffled by everything I was seeing, and how normal everybody else considered what was happening. "Oh, that's just Gavin," someone explained when I asked what the hell was going on, as if that should somehow satisfy my curiosity. But that night, I had one of those end-of-a-rom-com kind of moments when time sort of slows down around you and the lights all fade together, and you just kind of sit back and smile at how everything's played out while everybody slowly dances around your head, gyrating in Princess Leia lingerie and Lucha Libre headgear. I don't even think I got up and sang that night, but it was one of those moments where I felt like I was among my people, where I could do anything and not feel embarrassed or ashamed. After that evening, karaoke became a main staple of my idea of New York City nightlife. It took a while before I got comfortable enough to get on stage, but watching everybody else, how confident they were, even when they could barely sing, was inspiring. When I finally did sing, I performed a stirring rendition of And I Am Telling You from the soundtrack to Dreamgirls, and the applause that I got after was one of the greatest feelings ever. Karaoke changed my worldview. What's the worst that can happen besides disappointing Jennifer Hudson? So, when on-camera work became a possibility at BuzzFeed, I felt like I could do it, or at least try it. What's the worst that could happen? Besides disappointing Jennifer Hudson. So we started filming a series of videos where I'd get drunk at my desk, an entire bottle of wine in only a few minutes, rant about one thing or another, then hastily edit a 5-minute cut together, often still drunk, and post it to Facebook. In a matter of weeks, those videos got millions of views, and they soon became our very own version of must-see internet. Karaoke on the biggest stage. Maybe not the biggest stage, but a much bigger one than I was used to. It was exciting but terrifying. Drunk moms from Minnesota started stopping me in the street. I was interviewed by a Canadian news station. It was all happening. And then, one afternoon in late 2015, about a year into posting videos, I got a tweet from a random stranger asking if I knew I was nominated for a People's Choice Award. I had no idea. I didn't believe it. People tweet me a lot of shit, and of all the shit people have tweeted at me, nobody had ever asked if I was nominated for a People's Choice Award. I was understandably suspicious. But then I looked it up, and it was true. I was nominated for a People's Choice Award for Favorite Social Media Star. Granted, this was only the shortlist, some 20 people who might be nominated if all their followers voted for them, and the other people in my category were people who, in some cases, had tens of millions more followers than I had. There'd be no way in hell I'd make it beyond the shortlist. And sure, like they tell you, it's an honor just to be nominated or shortlisted, but nobody wants to be shortlisted when they could win. And I wanted to win. But I'm not lying when I tell you I have no idea how the hell this shit works. Nobody tells you anything. I didn't even know I was on the shortlist until some random person on Twitter told me. They don't send you an email saying, hey, this is how shit works. You just have to figure it all out yourself. But I made a half-assed effort to try to get people to vote for me, and they did. A handful of weeks later, they announced the finalists. Some guy from some TV show that I've never watched got up to the little podium and read out the nominees for my category, and he mispronounced the hell out of my name, but he said my name. I was officially nominated. Not just a shortlister, but a full-blown, actually could maybe win this shit, will maybe get to go to the show in Hollywood, nominee. If I died that night, no matter how grimly, my obituary would still cite me as People's Choice Award nominee Matt Bellassai. As in, People's Choice Award nominee Matt Bellassai died today choking to death on an egg roll in his apartment. He was found peacefully at home, naked in bed, covered in duck sauce, watching homosexual pornography. He will be incinerated in a Krispy Kreme oven this Saturday, and his ashes will be thrown at Beyonce at her earliest possible convenience, as per his last will and testament. For the weeks after that, I made a not-so-subtle effort for votes. But of course, there was no way of telling how well I was doing. One of the other nominees, a teen heartthrob with vague abs and a full head of hair, was trending worldwide on Twitter. No matter how many times my mother assured me she was voting, my efforts seemed futile. But I still campaigned to the very last moment. I didn't hear anything for weeks, and I still had no idea what was going on. I didn't even know if I'd get to go to the award show. I didn't know what dress I was wearing. I didn't know if I could bring a guest or if alcohol would be provided or if I had to bring my own from home. But finally, I got word that I'd be attending the show. All the nominees were indeed invited. And I had only a few weeks to get myself to Los Angeles, get an outfit, and figure out the alcohol situation. Now, I'm not a particular fan of Los Angeles as a city or as a concept. I'd been there countless times since then, but before the award show, I'd only been once or twice, and I hadn't gotten used to the city's bullshit. Of course, now I understand how to navigate the city. Never make direct eye contact with anybody who's going or recently been to hot yoga. Never agree to take a wheatgrass shot, and never disrespect In-N-Out, even though their french fries aren't even that good. Overall, though, it's too hot, there's too much traffic, and everybody is too beautiful for society to function properly. No community can ever last if everybody in it is beautiful all the time. No matter how much I love getting my Starbucks from a barista who looks exactly like Zac Efron, we need ugly people to balance out the world. That's just how it works. Besides, everybody in Los Angeles is certifiably insane. I had an Uber driver in L.A. who told me her ex-husband kidnapped her children, and before I had a chance to fully express my shock, she told me she was currently working on a screenplay about the entire incident, and every ounce of human emotion I had in that moment evaporated. The week of the award show, I had to find something to wear, and I went with someone from BuzzFeed to help me pick out the finest suit we could find at the men's warehouse in L.A. And yes, before you question whether I'm telling the truth, let me assure you, I did actually wear a men's warehouse suit to an award show where I was nominated. Hollywood. You grow up watching televised award shows and assume everybody there is dressed in Versace that Donatella personally stitched onto each of their bodies, but the truth is, half the people at any given award show, and there are hundreds of these things happening every week, are wearing a bargain dress from Sears and at least 5 layers of compression underwear. Unless you're Lady Gaga and show up with a team of specialists who pluck, pinch, and plaster over any semblance of what makes your body a normal human body, you're on your own. So yes, we picked out a fabulously gray men's warehouse suit, the color of zombie skin, and paired it with a black shirt and gray and black plaid tie. I looked like a slightly more pampered version of a JCPenney store manager. Seriously. If I could go back and change anything about what happens in this entire chapter, I would change this outfit, and we haven't even gotten to the night of the award show yet. It was that drab. The day of the awards is an uncharacteristically gloomy day in Los Angeles, a wonderfully foreboding sign of what's to come. It's a Wednesday, and I assume they're holding it in the middle of the week to get a discount on the theater. Besides, Ellen DeGeneres will be there, and you're not getting Ellen to come out on a Friday night. Around 11 a.m. is when the grooming starts, which is a ridiculously early and counterproductive time to start pampering yourself. I sweat through at least 3 layers of clothing before lunch on a normal day. How am I supposed to make it to the show in one piece if we start this early? But considering that every show taped on the West Coast is recorded for the East Coast primetime audience, everything in Los Angeles has to start 3 hours earlier than any normal human behavior. Now, everybody at any event in Los Angeles is groomed to within an inch of their life. Men, women, children, dogs, half of them have their hair and makeup done just to go to Whole Foods. And frankly, considering everybody in that city is so horrifically gorgeous, I don't blame them. Whenever I'm in LA, I try wearing the biggest pair of sunglasses to cover as much of my face as possible to save myself the embarrassment of being compared to the natives. On a day like this, where there will be cameras and lights and a red carpet, you better believe the bar is raised. Fortunately, I was getting pampered. It's not my favorite thing in the world to have someone painting my face with makeup. I have a bad history with makeup. When I was 5, my mother insisted on dressing me up as Frankenstein's monster for Halloween, a costume that seemed adorable, but required that she apply a thick layer of chalky green makeup to my face every time we needed to pose for pictures. I hated the smell of that makeup. It smelled of melted Tupperware full of old chili, and she absolutely refused to let me wear the costume without the face of makeup. But every time she tried to apply it to my face, I'd start violently gagging and thrashing, and the tears would streak through the makeup, and any bit of it that she would manage to get on my face would be smeared off in seconds anyway. There is no existing picture of this Halloween that doesn't feature my tear-streaked face. But it's a lot easier to get through the makeup process when you're 25 and can legally be wasted during it. And besides, on this day, I was getting the good stuff. BuzzFeed was paying for everything, or rather, BuzzFeed had to pay for everything because I didn't have any money. To be honest, I'm not entirely sure what I would have done without a company like BuzzFeed. You could be nominated for an award, and you still gotta fly yourself to the city it's in, get yourself a hotel room, get an outfit, hair, makeup, shoes, transportation to the venue, a male prostitute to keep you warm that night. It's a whole big deal, but I guess that's what credit cards are for. There was a brief hiccup when the hairstylist decided to give me 2004 Green Day emo throwback comb-over bangs, but we managed to course correct soon enough. I squeezed myself into my hideous suit and finally hopped into a van with my entourage. A BuzzFeed publicist, there to ensure that I didn't embarrass the company, I'm sure, me, and my date for the evening, Jeremy, a video producer who helped create the mess that got us there in the first place. When you pull up to an award show, it's absolute chaos. After the initial shock hits that you're on a red carpet, just like on TV, and there's lights and cameras and beautiful people wearing horrifying amounts of bronzer, you start to realize that there's absolutely no order or reason to what is happening. I imagine this is what animals who have been held in captivity feel like when they're released back into the wild. There's a faint sense of familiarity to everything. These are human beings with faces and limbs. I recognize those things. But everything else is sheer pandemonium, or at least controlled pandemonium. When you get out of the car, it's like getting onto the world's worst conveyor belt. You're whisked into a tent and along a path through a security checkpoint where a guard with a gun judges you when you empty your pockets and all that's inside is lip gloss and oil blotting sheets. Once you're deemed safe, you step right onto the stretch of carpet where attendees stop and pose for photographs before taking another 10 steps and then stopping again and so on and so forth until everybody dies a fiery death. There's no order to it, or at least not at the People's Choice Awards, so the sequence of people walking along the carpet is simply the sequence of people who happen to arrive at that very moment. And in this very moment, I happen to be sandwiched between Kate Hudson and Jack Black. And let me tell you, photographers don't give a shit about you, especially when someone more famous is within 5 feet of where you're standing. But that doesn't change the order of things. So then you're walking along the carpet, and photographers are shouting at you, but not as loud as they're shouting at Kate Hudson and Jack Black. You can feel the corners of your mouth shaking, partly because your cheeks are starting to ache from smiling, but partly because you're afraid your bangs fell back to Green Day status. A typical photographer interaction goes like this. Who are you? I'm Matt. What do you do? I write stuff on the internet. At this point, the photographer's face always drops. Oh, I'm nominated for an award, I shouted at one of them in indignation. And then, fine, look over here and try not to look like you're shitting your pants. Okay, nobody actually said that, but they might as well have. When the photographer stands in, someone pushes you out of the way to make room for Jack Black, and the conveyor belt continues. The next part of the carpet is where all the press stands waiting with lights, cameras, and microphones, craning their necks to see who's coming along the carpet. Typically, this is the part where your publicist walks ahead of you, goes up to some of the reporters, and says, I have Matt Bellassai, the guy with the wine. And the reporters will shrug their shoulders and shake their heads. Typically, your publicist will try to get far enough ahead of you so that you don't have to bear witness to this rejection firsthand, but the carpet is far too crowded for you to stray too far without getting lost, so you hear all of it. Nobody wants to talk to an internet writer when Kate Hudson just walked through. And of course, I was well prepared for this part of the carpet. After all, I was a writer at BuzzFeed for a couple of years before then, and had found myself on the other side of the carpet rope plenty of times, waiting for one celebrity or another to walk by so I could scream their name and pray they'd stop and give me some innocuous quote. I'd had plenty of hapless publicists come up to me and whisper, I have so-and-so from so-and-so, and I'd shyly wag my head and shrug my shoulders and hope that they didn't take it personally. It's all part of the never-ending fuckfest that is Hollywood. But the conveyor belt plugs along regardless of your feelings. After getting rejected by one too many people with microphones, you're pushed through another tent, and then a walkway, and then someone is scanning your ticket and handing you a badge, and you're shoved inside the theater like cattle shoved into a slaughter truck. The conveyor belt has ended, and somehow, you've survived. We finally got inside the venue, and honestly, I don't even remember what series of hallways and entrances we walked through to get backstage, but the event staff led us to a tiny green room where we would hang out before the show started. Now, at this point, I'd seen plenty of celebrities who had, at some time or another, made their way to BuzzFeed for photographs or interviews. I wouldn't consider myself a person easily star-stricken, no matter how much I fawn over my favorite celebrities on Twitter. But on this night, I was seriously bugging out. Because this green room was literally the holding room for every single celebrity who was there that night. On one couch sat the entire cast of Grey's Anatomy, and sure, that show has been on since the dawn of time, but still, I'd certainly never been in the same room with any of them. In one corner, there was Sandra Bullock and Melissa McCarthy and all of the hot people from those CW shows whose names I can never remember but whose abs I've seen on the internet. In another corner stood Chris Hemsworth, in all his meaty glory, and had I not been so deliriously paralyzed by everything that was happening, I would have taken a handful of him. But too much was happening all at once. All I could think to do was ask a person with a staff badge where, perhaps, I could find some alcohol, and she looked at me with eyes that suggested she thought I'd somehow snuck inside, before telling me that there was no alcohol backstage. But in any case, the show was starting in only a few minutes, and we had to find our seats inside the theater. Of course, when you walk into any theater in Los Angeles, especially when you haven't gotten used to this kind of thing, you sort of lose your breath. It's almost impossible to